Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this edition of The Game. I'm Russ Cohen, and we're waiting on Nico Riesgo, and right now on the line we have a special guest, Harvey Frommer. He is the author of Remembering Fenway Park, a really beautiful, big table book, coffee table book that really talks about the whole history of the Red Sox and that beautiful park of theirs. How are you, Harvey?
I'm doing well, Rich. How about you?
Good. I'll tell you what, the Fenway Park, really an amazing place. It really, I had a chance to go there for a baseball game and for a hockey game. It was great for both. You know, one's in the summertime, one was in the wintertime. And I can never get enough of that place. You really, no matter how many new ballparks go up, you really can't replace the atmosphere that you get, and you know that the history is there for that ballpark.
That's true. The old Yankee Stadium, I had a lot of it, but it's no longer there. And the new Yankee Stadium really is a new kid on the block. There's nothing quite like Fenway. It's where Mantle and Maris and also Jimmy Fox and Ted Williams and Mel Parnell and Bob Feller played. The ghosts are there still. The park will be 100 years old next year. And my book, Remembering Fenway Park, interviewed 140 people, including you, as you recall, your memories of Mets and Red Sox. And it was a very nice bit of information you gave me. And the book was a labor of love, and people are calling it the definitive book on Fenway Park, and I believe that it is because it weighs almost 4 pounds. It's got 140 voices, it's got 100,000 words, it's got over 200 photos and 240 pages. And I needed all of that and more to truly capture the history of that ballpark.
No question. Harvey, I can hear a little something in your background. I'm not sure if you're able to eliminate that. I'm going to bring Nico on and just see, as a ball player, if he had a chance to play at Fenway. I never asked him. Nico, how's it going? Did you ever get a chance to play at Fenway Park?
Hey, what's up, Russ? No, I never got a chance to play at my dream Fenway Park, but I did get a chance to play within the Red Sox organization. And it was a funny thing that happened. We talked about it in the book, Strike 3. The Red Sox actually traded for me during the strike. It was amazing. I came up and played and crossed the line with the Montreal Expos. And I think because I was so close with Felipe Alou, the management there, and some of the people, I think they knew what was going to happen, and they were trying to get me out of town. And at the same time, they thought if I would be able to get into Fenway Park, that would definitely bring baseball back. So they traded me, and I got a chance to play in Fort Myers. Mm-hmm. So we were playing down in Fort Myers, and I hit a few home runs out there. And one of the home runs I hit went out of the stadium and went over the fence, and back behind that area there was a lake where there's some alligators there, and the ball was in the lake. And the fan just went, disregarding alligators and all, jumped in the water to grab the ball and hold it up. The baseball was back, and they had the cameras on it from the Red Sox. And after that, the strike ended basically the next couple of days. It was over.
Yeah, I would say that pretty much exemplifies the crazy Red Sox fans, wouldn't you say, Harvey? They're a different breed.
They are a different breed. That's why the scene at Fenway is so interesting and exciting. The ballpark, even with all of the innovations and the refurbishments and the reimagining, is still a place where it was built for people who had smaller bodies and smaller tushies, as they say. So that you could feel almost as if you're being wedged into those seats in some instances. You also could have a bad sight line. Your seat may be facing a bullpen, and you have to crane your neck to really twist it out to the field. And if you're in the middle of a row and you want to go to the men's room or the ladies' room, it could be a stretch. But nevertheless, with all the problems that are posed by a ballpark that was built in 1912, it opened in 1912, it's still a dream place to be, because you're incredibly close to the action. It's something like Ebbets Field used to be. You can really almost read the players' lips and see the action that's going on there. and it's an intergenerational ballpark, which is another interesting thing. You see grandfathers and fathers and grandkids together, and they are very, very knowledgeable baseball fans. That I can tell you from being there now as a New Englander. We've been up in New England now for 16 years, and I'm a native New Yorker, but going to Fenway, it's a real treat just to be there and to soak up the atmosphere.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, the people who work there have a real pride for it. They, when we went there and we were covering the Winter Classic there, we got a behind-the-scenes tour, and the gentleman who was doing that was just proud to be working there for so long, and he was pointing out the seats that were still there from the very beginning of the ballpark, and then, you know, he was walking us by the basically where they had all the plaques, and for some reason, I guess because I am a tortured Met fan, the first plaque that I noticed was Mo Vaughn, even before Cy Young. My eyes focused in on Mo Vaughn. That was kind of bad, and then they eventually brought us into the Green Monster itself.
Yeah.
And to me, that was one of the biggest thrills of my life. So I'm in there, and I'm trying to find maybe, you know, the greatest signature that I can find. And no slight to this guy, and this is totally random. The first one I saw was Wayne Hagen, who actually, he does Met broadcasts. I mean, it's just, I couldn't get away from it.
Yeah.
But then I ended up finding a couple other guys that I remember from my childhood, and it was just fun being in that wall and looking out and seeing what the view was like from the guys who actually, you know, changed the scoreboard.
Yeah, well, that's one of the strengths, in my opinion, of the book. I have the guy who runs the manual scoreboard. I also have a guy named Ed Carpenter, who is like their premier tour guide. I don't know if you had a guy named Ed Carpenter.
I think that may have been him, yeah.
Yeah, Ed Carpenter. He's really knowledgeable and very nice. And the book has the stories not only of Red Sox players past and present, but also players who played against the Red Sox, and also just people who work at the ballpark and ordinary fans. One of my favorite items was a picture that takes up a full page of Nuns Day, and I never even knew there was such a thing as Nuns Day, but back in the 50s,
yeah.
60s, they used to come in the hundreds to Fenway Park, courtesy of Cardinal Cushing at that time, who was a big deal in Boston politics and also in religion. And the Red Sox didn't draw, so there was a sea of these nuns in their habits just sitting there and cheering on the home team. I interviewed a guy whose first game when he was 8 years old was a game that in front of him saw him being thrilled by the sight of all of these nuns, and they gave him Hershey bars, and they patted him on the head, and they kidded around with him. The next game the kid went to was also one that he looked forward to seeing the nuns, but there were no more nuns there. He thought it was an everyday occurrence.
Interesting. What do you think about that, Nico? That's kind of interesting. Nico, can't hear you. Nico, I'll tell you what. I think you're going to need to call back in or try and work something
okay.
with your phone. Okay,
can't
now
hear
I
me?
Got you.
Okay.
Now, okay.
Okay.
Now we got you. So what were you saying?
Okay. I said, I think I'd probably hit 3 or 4 home runs every day. I'd love to play in front of a bunch of nuns.
That's a
probably
good line.
Make me a better man.
It might make you a better man.
That's right.
And
I'd
Harvey,
be hitting the ball. I mean, every single ball.
I'll tell you, the photography in this book, Harvey, is second to none. I learned so much, and I see the picture of the nuns, and it really is amazing with the umbrellas that they're holding.
Yeah, isn't that
but
great?
It is. I have a soft spot for Ted Williams. You know, my dad was a big fan.
Everybody
he grew up in
does,
that era.
Yeah.
And I hated what happened to him, and we actually had been in touch with one of his daughters, the one that doesn't like what happened to him. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on what's happened with Ted, and if you think that that's one of the great injustices of baseball and maybe even of mankind. I mean, I just can't believe that he's still, you know, frozen in the state that he's in, and it's all against his wishes.
I think it's like one of the true horror tales of our time. It, to me, is like disgusting and just disrespectful to his name and to his image. so many of the people, the book could have been all on Ted Williams at Fenway Park, because so many people had a Ted Williams story. There was a story from Mel Parnell in the 1950s, who was a teammate of Ted Williams back then, who said that Ted came out one day and he started complaining that home plate was put down in the wrong way. And he protested that it should be readjusted. Anyway, it wasn't readjusted until the next morning when the groundskeepers came out and they remeasured, and Ted had this magnificent vision. He was correct about that. Also, September 28th, 1960 is in the book. I'm an oral historian, as you know, at Dartmouth College. I teach our students how to do this. And I got about six, seven, eight people who were at that game September 20th, 1960, when Williams hit the final home run of his career. He went around the bases playing third with Brooks Robinson, because they played the Orioles that day, and Brooks told me I wanted to shake his hand or hit him on the back or something, but I just watched as he disappeared into the dugout. Well, Williams just did not tip his cap. He didn't come out for any curtain calls. There was no band playing. That was it. The team actually, after the game, went on to play the Yankees at Yankee Stadium the last three games of that season, but it was a lost season for the Red Sox. Williams didn't even make the trip. He did it his way. So for a man so strong-willed, so idiosyncratic, such a tempestuous Ted, as they called him, to be treated this way after death, to me, is the only word that comes to my mind quickly is disgusting.
And what's your thoughts on that, Nico? Like I said, we've done plenty of coverage of it on Sportsology, and it seems like it's just a forgotten thing at this point.
It shouldn't be forgotten. I think it's something. I think there was a book written about it, and I think hopefully there'll be a movie about the situation sometime soon that we can visually see it. It's a sad thing that's happened after his life, but I think his spirit still lives, and I know it lives within me. I'm captured by his spirit and the man that he was, the greatness that he gave to the game. And he, you know, definitely has motivated many baseball fans and many players. Like I said, even active players today, I think, will still talk about Ted Williams as one of the greatest hitters of all time. And that's what I try to focus on.
No, that's good.
The Red Seat, which is in Fenway Park now, allegedly commemorating the longest shot hit by a Red Sox player, I learned about that also. That's a little bit of fiction, but it's homage to Ted Williams. When he hit that shot, there were metal rows there. There was no red seat. And then when they changed into seats in that area, they approximated where the ball hit, and they created a red seat. And when Williams died, the entire season of his death, that red seat was left open, so nobody sat in it. But Manny Ramirez actually hit a shot that was further, but somehow with the measurements it came out a couple of feet shy. So Williams has that.
That's awesome. I like that. That's a little hometown scoring. Now, Harvey, being a fellow author, and since you are an oral historian, and maybe people who are listening and who will listen to this will, you know, think about doing a book, tell them. At least from my perspective, I think the hardest thing about doing a book is the transcribing of the interviews. Tell me if you agree with that, or tell me what you think the hardest thing is when you go and tackle a book like this, which is a great undertaking.
I think every aspect of it is difficult. And this is my 41st sports book, and my wife, Myrna, and myself have written five oral histories, so that pushes us up to 46, and I have also four ghostwritten books, so I'm at the half-century mark, more or less. The whole process is difficult. I find the most difficult part is what you leave out. This book could have been, Remembering Fenway Park, could have been three, four times the size. It's 100,000 words right now. I also had 800 photos, and we had to cut down to 225. So I think it's just the elimination, the cutting down to the heart of the artichoke, as we tell our students. And people, you know, people talk, but with oral history, I would say maybe 20% of what you get is usable. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on to the cutting room floor, or in any interview, you know, people digress and you get a lot of ers and ums, and they go off into topics that you're not interested in. But it's a joy to do them. It's an honor for me to have written Remembering Fenway Park as kind of a back-to-backer with Remembering Yankee Stadium. So those are two of the books I've written that I take a lot of pride in.
Well, you really should, because they're, you know, one's going to live on, one isn't living on, and I think it's easy for me as a Met fan to say, hey, I like the original Yankee Stadium a lot better. I've been to both, and I just felt like because Ruth had played there, no disrespect to Jeter or A-Rod or any of the current guys, but they can never really live up to, you know, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio, and I don't think they'll ever have that type, those types of players. What do you think about that, Harvey? Is it just a situation where you go to the new place and you say, yeah, it's nice, but it's just never going to have that same feeling?
It can't have that same feeling, excuse me, because all of the marker moments that were achieved by the guys you mentioned took place in the old stadiums. So maybe it is progress, but a lot of the new stadiums, including the new Yankee Stadium, were built for profit in many ways, with luxury boxes and the crowding out the average fan. And the old stadiums still had cheaper seats, families could come there, et cetera. So the history really belongs to the old stadiums, and there's basically only Fenway Park and Wrigley Field left. And ironically, or unbelievably, do you know what the third oldest stadium is?
I'm going to say, let's see, third oldest stadium. Boy, it's going to probably be ironic. Chavez Ravine.
You got it. Dodger Very stadium. Good, yeah. Very few okay. know that. And ironically, the Camden Yards place is going to be celebrating its 25th anniversary. So
boy, we're getting old.
Flies.
And that's what, a brand new park. I mean, it's still contemporary.
Yeah, it's
we're
brand
the first
new, but it's
modern, new
one. Quarter century old.
Yeah, it's certainly
yeah.
newer, Nico, but it's hard to believe it has been around that long. And,
yeah.
and Nico, you played in some of these parks, and what's your feeling about when you see – I don't know, when you see a place like Fenway as compared to a place like the new Yankee Stadium? I mean, you live in Detroit. Detroit Stadium was built right around that same time as Fenway and the others, and you watched that place get torn down.
Yeah, it was sad. That was a very sad day in baseball when they tore down the old Tiger Stadium. And for some reason, I had a dream that we would keep that stadium and turn it into a modern baseball stadium with a National League franchise there. To compete here in the city. So that way the stadium itself will be used for historical days like, you know, Hall of Fame days, where we can bring back the legends of who played in the old-time stadiums, the Babe Ruths, the Ty Cobbs, and all the famous, you know, all-star games that were played there, the famous shot by Reggie Jackson that hit the light tower. So many stories in that stadium. I think if baseball could have captured that stadium, turned it into a museum stadium, had National League in there, and then, you know, shared revenues with the Tigers if there was any obligation there. I think, you know, that was a bad decision by Major League Baseball not to save that stadium. But,
nope,
you know,
no
seeing
question.
It.
Now, I was going to say, bringing it back a little bit, though, to Harvey's book, the foreword was written by a legend. You had mentioned legends, and that's Johnny Pesky. And I guess at this point, Harvey, he would be the number one guy in Red Sox history, right?
Well, I think so. There's also Bobby Doerr, who is still around. They're both in the early
Sure, Bobby Doerr, yep.
Yeah, and he's the oldest living Hall of Famer. Pesky is not that well these days, and he missed the first spring training of his career this time around. But he is a wonderful gentleman, Mr. Red Sox, and he has been, you know, with the team in so many capacities that he's just a dream guy to be around. I just hope he keeps on, you know, going forward with his life and enjoying his time there. But I was told a very, very touching story, and I've had some really momentous moments in my long writing career. But this one really touched me. His son called me up because he got his copy of the book, our book, Remembering Fenway Park. And he ripped open the package, sat down on the couch, and he didn't move off that couch for 3.5 hours, and he had tears in his eyes.
Wow.
So for me to hear that, no matter what, how well the book sells or how many wonderful things people say about it, to know what he is like, that was a magic moment.
That really is a magic moment. And for people listening out there, I had that same sort of thrill when I got that book. I wasn't expecting it the day in the mail that I got it, and I think, Harvey, you weren't expecting me to get it that quick either, and it was just – it was a great thrill. I am such a big baseball fan that I did want to just rip into it, and of course, yeah, I have to admit I did look at the page that I was on first. But after that – I'm human, right? But after that, I wanted to see everything, and I really, and my wife was very impressed with that, and it takes a lot to impress my wife if she's sort of sitting on the couch not paying attention, and which she was, and she really loved the look of it and everything else, and so just you see something like that, and I know you have to feel proud about it because, A, it's hard work, but B, if people are calling it the definitive Red Sox book, they should, because there's really no stone unturned. I mean, you spoke to guys ranging from Mike Lowell, Tom Brunansky, you know, we mentioned Johnny Pesky. Really, anybody who's everybody is in there.
Jerry
and then also
there's another guy.
Yeah, even guys like John Miller, you know, guy, you know, writers, broadcasters. You really got
Roger
everybody.
Roger Kahn is in the book.
Yeah, Roger Kahn. I mean,
that's his memory. So I try to do everything. And the book basically is not only the history of Fenway Park, but it's also the history of the Boston Red Sox at the same time. And it's not just another pretty face or pretty coffee table book. Some of these books are slapped together, and you got a lot of big photos, but very little text. I have 100,000 words in this book, so it is a lot of writing that went into it. And some of it is negative also. It's not just a puff piece about the Red Sox. Back in 1945,
right,
I recall and recount and play back that tryout when Jackie Robinson, Sam Jethro, and Marvin Williams were found wanting by the Red Sox, and they were not signed. And Robinson said it was just a sham. It was just a public relations stunt. And the Red Sox were the last team to get a black player, Pumpsy Green, in 1959, and I interviewed Pumpsy, who told me that Tom Yawkey, you know, was very sweet to him in terms of offering him more money and places to stay and people to meet, et cetera, et cetera. But it was a dozen years after Jackie Robinson broke the color line with the Dodgers that Pumpsy Green came along. And all due respect to Pumpsy, he was not the most talented of players that they could have signed, and Sam Jethro, who was at that tryout with Jackie Robinson, he moved on to become a great star with the Boston Braves. So that's just one of the negatives that we have in the book. And people talk about the curse of the Bambino, which was the selling by Harry Frazee of the Babe to the Yankees and changing the course of baseball history, making the Yankees a powerhouse along with other players they got from the Red Sox. But also, I think there's a thing that could be called the curse of Tom Yawkey. He was a benevolent, wonderful owner. He gave kids who shagged flies for him $20. He would rip up a guy's contract if a guy pitched a no-hitter or did something sensational. And he kept buying players. But on the other hand, when they asked him how come Robinson and Jethro and Williams, you know, were found wanting, his response was that he doesn't make the baseball decisions, which to me was total bull.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the book is not just a puff piece, but it's warts and all trying to get at the true story of Fenway Park.
Yeah, now I'll tell
you
what.
A question, Harvey.
Go ahead, Nico.
Sure. Let me ask you a question about the replacement players for the Red Sox organization. Are these considered players, or are these like a memory of the Red Sox past, or is this something that's going to basically never appear in any documented Red Sox literature or publication of these players playing it within the organization? Do you mention the strike at all in your book?
No. That's a very good question, and perhaps I should have, but since there was a strike, I could have at least gotten into what was happening at Fenway Park during the strike. I guess nothing was happening. So that's why I didn't mention it.
It's a fair point.
I'm putting myself down.
No, well, you shouldn't. I mean, it's a fair point, and actually, and Nico, we definitely have to thank Harvey for helping us out with our book and giving us something for the cover there. So that was very nice of him. But no, Harvey, look, if nothing was going on at Fenway Park, I think it's a fair point that you wouldn't put anything on it because, yeah, well, I mean, other than if you just mentioned it, and I guess someone like Nico, who is a part of it, maybe would feel better if you had just said, hey, nothing was going on at Fenway Park and you mentioned it, but then that's probably one of those things that would hit the cutting room floor.
Right, yeah.
Because it's just, it's hard to fit in. But
there was so
I do want to let people...
So much stuff to put in, you know, so many things.
Yeah.
And a couple of people who I interviewed for an hour, and they said, look, all I got is a couple of paragraphs. You know, so I said, well, it's not that the stuff wasn't good. It was just how it worked in the book itself.
Right, and that's you're right. That is a very difficult part. I want to let listeners know I just put my review up again of the book with a link to buy it up on top of Sportsology, but you could also go to Amazon. You can go to any bookstore. Harvey, I know you've got some signings coming up. Why don't you let us know what you have coming up?
Well, I'll be in the Boston area around Father's Day in Barnes & Noble and independent stores. I'll be in New York City in mid-May. I'm going to be at R.J. Julia, which is a wonderful bookstore in Connecticut. That will be, I think, May 14th. But R.J. Julia, people are in the Connecticut area. And people could always send me a line. My email is harvey.fromer@dartmouth.edu if you want to just chat back and forth.
Well, and I'll tell you what, I'll definitely be looking for you. Maybe I'll finally catch up with you in New York. Sometimes with my hockey writing, it all depends if it's a game night and if somebody's in the playoffs still. So we'll try and do that. But, Harvey, I really appreciate you coming on the show and, again, talking about this great book. Congratulations on it. I think it's going to be a big success, and I think that you will have nothing but success with it.
Right. Well, thanks very much for having me on the show. It was just pleasant spending some time with you this morning, and good luck with all of your endeavors, too.
Thanks,
Let me ask you a quick question, another quick question, Harvey, if you got a minute, about the current Red Sox. What do you think about Adrian Gonzalez? What do you think of their chances of winning the series this year now?
I'm predicting here and now that the Red Sox can win the championship. They'll all be coming together. They did really well in the last series, swept it. And Dice K seems to be coming back to his old form. And I don't know if I mentioned this to you, Rich, but people change their religion and convert. I have changed my loyalty. I was an ultimate Yankee fan all of these years, having lived in New York. And I really now have truly converted to a member of Red Sox Nation.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So that's... Yeah. You know, I was a Mets Sox fan for a short time, but in 86, that sort of snapped me back, and I had to go back and root for the Mets when they were in the World Series against them. But, Harvey, I completely understand that. I'm going to let you go. We're going to talk about a little bit more current baseball, but, again, everybody should get the book Remembering Fenway Park. And, again, Harvey, thanks so much for taking the time out.
Right. And the best place to get it is probably Amazon because it's a $45 book. At Amazon, it's only $29.70.
That's awesome. And, Harvey, thanks. We'll catch you down the road.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
All right, Nico, let's talk a little bit. We'll go into a little overtime here, and people who aren't listening live can get this off the stream. So, regular baseball, you know, Mets won a few in a row. I guess that'll calm me down for a little while. Jason Bay came back, another ex-Red Sox, who, by the way, when I took that tour of Fenway, that nice gentleman kept talking to me about how great Jason Bay is, what a great guy he is, and the Mets will be terrific with him. And I've yet to see that, but I think maybe, you know, he's starting to bring a little bit of good times there. But, you know, again, the team has so many issues. Let's I guess, talk about, you know, Doc Holliday, 14 strikeouts. Phillies look good at the moment, although they have some, you know, they have some issues, but they seem to be getting through them right now.
Oh, yeah, the Phillies are – kicking on all cylinders. They got Holliday. You know, he's looking at, basically he's in World Series form right now at the beginning of the year. So you got Oswald. You've also got Cliff Lee really kicking in. And then you've got, hey, he's no slouch there, the left-hander. So
yeah, call
you know, even with
yep.
some Yes, even with some of the injuries that they've had with that Utley there, I mean, they're winning every day, and that's what it takes to play this game if you want to be the best.
It does, and you do have to persevere, and so far they are managing to do that, and you're right, without Chase Utley, with having Ben Francisco in the outfield, who isn't the greatest outfielder, he could hit a little bit, but he really can't field. You know, they're still they're managing to get by, although the big surprise team so far in the National League East, the Florida Marlins, only a game and a half behind them. That is a little surprising.
It is, considering all their young talent and their payroll. I mean, what is their payroll?
I don't know what their current payroll is, but we know that it's not high. I would think they're in the lower 25% of the league, and they've done a good job of definitely getting prospects and having young pitching. Young pitching certainly can get you through. We like Josh Johnson. We like the guys on that team. But even hitting-wise, they're pretty good. They're 8-4 at home, and that's even better than the Phillies. They're one game up on the Phillies as far as being a home team. So that's impressive. Even the Nationals at 500, I think, gives those fans hope for next year when Steven Strasburg will hit the mound again and Bryce Harper will get called up and they'll, you know, have probably one other rookie that they could insert into the lineup, and Jason Worth will be another year in that team, and that could be a good year for the Nationals.
Yeah, if they keep Matt Stairs, here's the guy we keep talking about year after year. He finds his way with team after team, and here I'm watching a game the other day, and who do I see sitting in the dugout cheering on the boys and helping that team rally and coming on into the late innings with a pinch hit. And just still on board, helping teams win ball games. I mean, last year I think he was with the Padres. It helped get them into the playoffs. And I wouldn't be surprised to find the Nationals in the playoffs this year.
Yeah, I would be shocked, but I guess I wouldn't be that shocked because they do have a pretty good hitting lineup, and they have some young pitchers now that are starting to come through for them. Switching over to the Central, I have to say I'm a little surprised that St. Louis is sitting atop even without Adam Wainwright. I'm not sure I would have thought that would have happened, and they're 7-3 in their last 10, which is better than Milwaukee and even Cincinnati right now. We're early on, but I have to say early on, that's looking good for the Cardinals because I think a lot of people like myself expected them to dip in that division.
Well, what the Cardinals got behind them has got leadership. They've got a guy named Tony La Russa, and they've got a guy named Albert Pujols, and they've got leadership every day. They've got a thing called the red turtleneck. I don't know if you've seen it lately, but all the players are now wearing the turtleneck. It's a team unity. And I'll tell you, when the team decides that they're going to do things together, they're going to win some ball games.
Yeah, no question. Colorado Rockies, I believe you may have picked them. I certainly didn't. They're off to a 14-7 start. I think the biggest reason is the health of Troy Tulowitzki. Is he possibly the best shortstop in baseball now and the guy who doesn't get talked about instead of Derek Jeter and guys like Jose Reyes, and we can go on, Hanley Ramirez, but it seems like Troy Tulowitzki might be the best in the game right now.
Absolutely. I mean, the numbers are talking right now. He's hot right now. He's hit the season off running. He's a great shape physically when you see him. He's got great range, great defensive players, great arm, great dynamic. You cannot say enough. Absolutely, the guy's the best player of the game right now. But it's a long season. He's got to perform this way the whole year. Colorado has got a secret weapon in Jim Tracy. Not many people know about Jim Tracy, but he's got the chance to play it for him. You're going to bust through that wall.
Yeah, right now, Tulowitzki's got a slugging percentage of .705, 7 homers, 16 RBIs, hitting .333. You can't really start off much better than that, that's for sure. Switching over, we'll talk about, I guess, for a moment, the troubles with the Dodgers. We'll just say it's an unfortunate situation. I could see the Mets going down that road, too, if they don't get this other investment group involved. But right now, Nico, the Dodgers are still 12-11. Give Don Mattingly credit. Even with all these distractions, he's keeping his team afloat.
Don Mattingly, he's a winner, and that's what you say. You can't, with all the off-the-field distractions, with the divorce, with the divorce, the C-League coming in and taking over the franchise there, not being able to make payroll, you've got leadership on the field such as Mattingly, where off the field distractions, it doesn't matter when you got a guy like Manley. He's a winner, and every single day that he steps to the ballpark, he wants to win. He infuses that to his team. He's got players like Max Kemp. He's got Andre Ether, I call Superman. These guys are phenomenal players. You know, they've got a pitching staff. They've got a team that can win the World Series.
Yeah, they could possibly do it. I think they'd be a long shot, but I don't disagree with you. I think they have the talent, and they definitely have the pitching staff to do it. Let's switch over and probably talk about the biggest surprise in all of baseball in the Central. We've got the Cleveland Indians sitting atop your Detroit Tigers, who you did pick, and they're right in there. They're a game and a half out, and even Kansas City's a game and a half out. I have to say, I'm skeptical about any of the league leaders right now. It's in that division. I really don't think KC and Cleveland will be there at the end. But I give them credit. They're off to a hot start.
They are. And like I said, they've got some great leadership there. Manny Ates came over from the National League. He's got some Montreal blood in him, a little bit of Felipe Alou mentorship. He knows what it takes to win ball games. He's got that pitching staff throwing strikes, and that's the fundamental thing, is pounding the strike zone, pounding the strike zone. He's got these young players named Azubro Cabrera at shortstop. Probably when you talk about Troy Tulowitzki, don't leave this guy out. Cabrera, just a passionate guy for the game. He's got some major tools. Who would have thought Hafner would be having as good as a start as Adrian Gonzalez? I think he's got half the money that Adrian Gonzalez has. But he's
Hafner gets paid pretty well. That was a sore point in Cleveland last year for the lack of production. He had just gotten a raise. Charles Hafner makes big money. Not the Gonzalez money, but he makes pretty big money for that team.
Well, it's coming through. He's coming through, getting some big hits. His leadership is coming through. One of the biggest boys I've ever seen in my life, so I don't think anyone's going to mess with him. They're playing hard. They've got Grady Sizemore back. They've got a team that can win it all.
They have a good team. I don't know if they can win it all. I'll switch to the West and say the Texas Rangers, even without Cliff Lee, are doing it. They're 14-7. That team is not surprising me. That team they've got a lot of young pitching. I really think the influence of Nolan Ryan is huge on their pitching staff. These guys don't have a pitch count. These guys pitch deep into games. They're sort of like the new Atlanta Braves, where they didn't worry about those things either under Leo Mazzoni. And right now, I think the interesting thing about the pitching staff on the Texas Rangers is they don't have a guy under 6 feet. Listen to this real quick. C.J. Wilson, 6'1", Brett Tomko, 6'4", Pedro Strop, 6 feet, Arthur Rhodes, 6'2", Darren Oliver, 6'2", Alexi Orgando, 6'4", Darren O'Day, 6'4", Colby Lewis, 6'4", Derek Holland, 6'2", Matt Harrison, 6'4", Cody Epley, 6'5", Dave Bush, 6'2". That has got to be the biggest pitching staff in Major League history. As a whole.
Absolutely, man. You called it right on the nose with Nolan Ryan. I mean, is there anyone bigger than Nolan Ryan? I think he's 6 foot, but he was probably the tallest 6 footer you've ever seen with his fastball.
No, no question. And I just think the influence there has really been tremendous. And again, when you look at the innings pitched, you'll see that they have 1, 2, 3, 4 guys with already over 25 innings pitched. They don't have any complete games, but their guys are going pretty deep, and I think that's a testament to Nolan. So the Yankees in first, I'm not surprised at, even though maybe their pitching isn't up to par. They still have great hitting. We saw that A-Rod had 6 RBIs the other day, and maybe we'll talk about the unauthorized biography of Derek Jeter someday. That's coming out, but not on this show. And that's kind of it, Nico. We'll wrap it up for this week. Any other thoughts that you have? You give out your address for MLPO.org and let us know what you're doing.
Yeah, MLPO.org. Visit us. Check out the TV channel, MLPO.tv, and send in some clips. We'd love to see all the young talent out there working out, training hard. Send us a video clip and we'll post it.
What about the old talent? Should I get my softball guys to videotape me and have you put it up there?
Absolutely, man. We're looking for everybody that's talented, that loves the game and has a passion. Show us your clips. We want to put it on there. We want to have a lot of fun. We want to promote the game, and that's what it's all about, Russ.
All right. Well, you know what? This week, you'll get a clip of me, a 48-year-old third baseman.
Awesome. I can't wait to see it.
All right.
I gotta
see
the swing though. Gotta be the swing.
All right, you'll see the swing. Last week I was 0-2, so I'm glad I didn't tape that. That's it for this week's edition of The Game. We'll catch everybody next time.
Hey, thanks, Rich.
All right, thanks, Nick.